Today is April 11th, 2012. This is Joey Beauchamp at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Joyce Tanik Schroeder over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. So why don't we go ahead and start? You can maybe give me a background on where you grew up, how you got involved in sports, and some of your earliest influences on your career.
Okay. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and when I was 3 years old, my mom started me in dancing school in Seattle at Lillian Turner Dance School, and because I was always running around, jumping and doing things in the house, and she thought maybe I should use this energy in a positive manner rather than just running around aimlessly. Uh-huh. And so I started the dance, the ballet, acrobatics, and tap, and I really liked the acrobatics part of it. So that was what I continued with. And we had a traveling tumbling teacher that would go around the country, and he came to Seattle. He was James Rosanis from the Chicago area. And I took a week tumbling class from him, and so that was my real first experience at the tumbling part of it, and I really liked it, and so continued with that, and the dancing, some ballet, but mostly in focusing on the tumbling and acrobatics part of it. And when I was nine, a gymnastic coach from Illinois, Frank Haland, came out to Seattle to be an assistant coach at the University of Washington in their men's gymnastic program. Uh-huh. And as a sidelight, he did tumbling lessons once a week and went around to all the dance studios trying to get interest for his classes. And so a friend and I went over to signed up for the dance class, and then or the tumbling class, and that's where we met one of my future YMCA teammates, and so he introduced us to actual gymnastics, and that was in probably 1960 when I was 10. Uh-huh. And we at first worked out at the University of Washington with the men's team on Sunday afternoons. We just went for a couple hours and did mainly tumbling and got introduced to the equipment a little bit and really enjoyed it. And Frank wanted us to go into a tumbling competition that was at the Seattle YMCA. And my friend Louise and I, we didn't want to enter because we didn't have any idea what was involved. So he said, well, come watch, and then maybe you can enter the next one. And so my mom and dad and Louise and I went down to the Y to watch the competition. And I don't remember saying this, but my mom said after the end of it, I told her that I should have entered because I could have won. Uh-huh. And so that was the beginning, and then shortly after that, he left for Eastern Montana to be the head gymnastic coach there, and he told us to go down to the Seattle YMCA, which was the downtown YMCA, right in the middle of downtown Seattle, and George Lewis was developing a coaching or gymnastic program for girls there. And so that's what Louise and I did, and that was in probably 1960-61, and that's how we got our start into actual gymnastics. Uh-huh. And my parents didn't push me at all. It was just something that kind of evolved, and I enjoyed, and they were very, very supportive. So that was how I got started.
Now, I'm not sure how high school sports, because nowadays, most sports run through the high schools. Was it mostly through the YMCA through the next, few years, or was it through
schools? Yes, my gymnastic team or club was the Seattle Downtown YMCA. I was in high school from, probably 65. I graduated in 68. And women's sports were just getting started, and I grew up in the Shoreline District, just north of Seattle. Uh-huh. And they were very proactive, I think, academically as well as in athletics. And so we did have a gymnastic team in high school, and the high school meets in the Seattle area were done once a month, and anybody who competed for a high school or high school had a team could go and enter these meets once a month. That was, it was a varsity sport, and then they also, Shoreline also had volleyball as a girls' sport, and along with some of the other teams in the Metro League. And I had looked up not too long ago, and basketball in 1969 was going to start being a girls' varsity sport. But the main emphasis then for women was through club sports, and so the Seattle Y was my main team throughout all my competition.
Right. So how did the road to ending up in the Olympics start for you then? Where did that all come about?
Okay. I was the club where we trained, they had probably a group of about six or seven girls already there. And so Louise and I joined. And then one of the gals, Dale Francis Kephart, she was on the eventually turned out to be on the 1964 Olympic team and also the 1962 World Championship team. And being from our club, she was a great role model to have. Very hard worker, great gymnast, just, and so it was really nice having her there at my club to see what could be accomplished and to give me incentive to continue.
Right.
And so when I was 12 years old, I remember saying that I wanted to be on the 1968 Olympic team, and that was in 1962. And so for the next 6 years, that was my goal. And again, having Dale there just really, really helped, someone to look up to and train with and learn from. And there were other goals along the way, but that was always my goal, the 1968 Olympics. You had to be 15 to compete internationally then in gymnastics, and it didn't matter if you were 15 a day after the Olympics or 15 2 days before, but you had to be 15 during the games. And now you just have to turn, I think it is 16, during the year of the Olympics, but then your birthday had to actually fall ahead. So I was too young for the 64 and not good enough anyway, but the 68, that was the next Olympic team. So that was my goal, and that's why that particular team. And so all my training was focused then towards making that team. And I was very fortunate to have a great coach in Seattle, and having Dale there and a lot of other great kids to train with, we had a really, really strong program, and everybody was willing to learn. So that I was 12 when I made that goal.
Uh-huh.
And fortunately, I achieved it.
Now, about what point did you feel like you had a good shot where you thought, you know, I am pretty good at this, and some result or something that happened?
I think I was always, from the very beginning, I was always, even if we entered just local events in the Northwest and then gradually worked out, worked into competitions with Vancouver, Canada a lot, and down in Oregon they had a YMCA down there that had a good club, and Eastern Washington had some. And I was always near the top. And especially when I was younger, I've mellowed now, but it was very important to me to be the best at whatever I did, regardless of if it was just starting out in gymnastics or we had school sports. And even in elementary school, the teachers would set up noontime leagues for basketball and softball we did, and they would set us up into teams and have us compete during lunchtime. And it was even very important in those kinds of things for me to win and be first. I'm not sure that's the best way to be, but but that's how I was. And looking back, I was just, it was so important to be the best. And so having some success at first in the competitions, and then also wanting to be the best, it was just kind of snowballed.
Yeah.
And in we had a junior national meet in Seattle in 1966, it was. And that was the first year I was old enough to compete on a national basis. And so that was the first national competition that I had looked for. And so I did win the all-around there. And then actually, yeah, I had turned 15 in September of 1965, and there was a Little Olympics. It was a pre-Olympic competition for in Mexico to help them get accustomed to running the big events and testing their venues.
Right, I think I've heard of that.
Yeah. And we called it was called the Little Olympics, or that's what we called it anyway. I don't know what the official name was, but it was basically a test event for the Mexicans, like they just had the London test event.
Right.
I know in gymnastics in January. And so that was the first national event I was eligible for, junior or senior. And so I remember we went to Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy for the trials for that. And there was only like 7 or 8 girls, and they were taking 3. And so I ended up being one of the finishing in the top 3. So I was able to go to the Little Olympics. And that was kind of a surprise. I really didn't know if I would have a chance, even though with 7 or 8 girls there. But I hit all my events and a couple others missed. So that's how I qualified for the team. And so it was really fortunate that that gave me more experience, and some of the top gymnasts in the world were there at that meet, and I don't think anyone realized that it was going to be that big a deal.
Right.
But that was my first introduction to really the international competition. And I do remember when the U.S. team was announced, we got booed in the stadium, and that was really a shock, as I, just being from the United States, I didn't think anybody would boo me.
Right.
But they did, so that was really an eye-opener. But that was my first international competition, and then won the Junior Nationals in 1966. And so that was probably when I knew I'd had to work hard, but I would keep working, and I thought I really had a shot at it.
Okay. And so when as the games are getting closer, tell me how that process happened where you, I guess, they'd have a trial to be able to be on the team and...
Yes, okay. 1968, our national meet was in Long Beach, California in usually May. And the process for the Olympic selection team that year was the top 25 from our national championships would be eligible to compete in the trials, which were the end of August, also in Long Beach, California. And we had a real strong team of, I think, 5 or 6 that went down from our Seattle Y. And I ended up that year finishing 2nd all around, and so qualified along with all of our other team members. We were in the top 25, so we all qualified for the Olympics or Olympic trials.
Right.
And so we spent the summer training for the trials. We usually worked out after school stopped for the summer. We usually worked out about 3 to 4 hours in the afternoon, and then took a break, had dinner, and then came back and worked about 3 hours in the evening. And so that was pretty much our schedule. We had a gymnastic camp at Camp Waskowitz in North Bend, Washington, and we all went up there. It was a great, great summer camp. You had all kids from very young to very old, or not very old, but and all levels, I guess, is what I mean to say. And so we worked as part-time instructors there, and then worked out half-time. And one of our coaches at the Y, not George Lewis, but another assistant coach, actually it was Dale, who had been on the 1964 Olympic team and had retired from gymnastics at that time. And she was also at this camp, so she set up our training program. And so we just were very rigid, and I was so focused. Looking back, I can't believe how focused I was on actually training. It was like nothing else existed in the world except me training as hard as I could to try and make that Olympic team.
Right.
So then the trials were in the end of August in Long Beach, California. We went through 2 complete meets. We had compulsories then, which everybody did the same routine, and then we had our optionals, which everybody did their own specific individual routine.
Right.
So we competed compulsories and optionals and combined those scores, then had a day rest, and then competed compulsories and optionals again. And our scores were just accumulative. So the top 10 were selected for the training camp. And our national champion that year was injured at the trials, so she was also what they call petitioned into the training camp.
Right.
So, let's see, myself and one other gal from, two others from our team were in the top 10. And so that was probably one of the best meets I've had, and I felt I was most prepared mentally and physically going into that meet.
Right.
Of all my competitions, and just everything was very, very fine-tuned and going almost like planned out second-by-second type thing, and it all came to fruition at the trials.
Now, you said you were really focused. You were still in high school about this time, did you say?
I had graduated in June of 68.
Okay.
From high school.
Gotcha.
And I'd already decided not to attend college until January of 69, because with the Olympics and the training and everything, it just would have been impossible.
Right, I understand that. So, obviously you're focused and you're training hard. Was there anything else going on in your life? It seems like this would have taken up pretty much all your time, right?
Yes, it did. Yeah. I know even during high school we worked out 6 days a week, and there was lots of activities, social activities, going to football, basketball games at high school that I didn't get to very much, but it was more important to me to focus on my gymnastics, and if I could, I went to the basketball games. I didn't get to very many or football games, but it was secondary, and I didn't really mind missing all that. My friends had a real hard time understanding that, and I know one of my very favorite teachers in ninth grade, we had a junior high system, so actually she was a junior high teacher in ninth grade, and I still keep in touch with her, and I remember her asking me one time, well, did you miss all the high school activities, and your friends always worried about you that you couldn't partake in all this? And I said, well, I knew I was missing, but it wasn't that important to me to miss those things. It was much more important to continue my training. So gymnastics was pretty much it. I remember during high school I would go to school, come home for a couple hours, do homework, and go to the gym. Usually get home around 10 o'clock and get ready for bed and finish homework or whatever I had to do, and usually about 11, 11:30, I went to sleep, and if it didn't get done, it didn't get done. But being busy and focused and time management was huge, and so I pretty much handled everything during high school, and it wasn't too stressful.
Good.
I didn't think.
Good. So now you said you're heading off to a camp after the trials.
Yes.
Were they going to narrow it down from there also, or is it just they were going to take all of you anyway?
They were going to narrow it down. They took 10 plus the national champion, who was injured. So there was 11 at the training camp, which was at camp. Or let's see, we were in South Lake Tahoe, and we trained at Zephyr High School.
Yep, know that area.
Know that, okay. And we stayed at Camp Richardson.
Uh-huh, I've heard of all those, yeah.
Okay, which is probably about, I'm trying to think, a 20-minute drive, maybe, to the school.
Uh-huh.
And we were in cabins, and there were three or four cabins there. And so they divided us up into cabins, and they had kind of like a dining hall there, which is probably the lodge of the campground, and that's where we ate. They had the cafeteria there. No, it wasn't cafeteria. We were served our meals. The volleyball team, men's and women's, was also training there, and I know they ate there. I'm assuming they stayed in the same cabins like we did.
Uh-huh.
The track team trained at South Lake Tahoe, but they stayed even higher up on the mountain. I don't remember specifically where, but they trained higher. They weren't at Camp Richardson with us. They were even higher elevation. And so we trained at Tahoe for a month, and we had very long workouts. We'd go into the gym anywhere from 8 in the morning to noon, depending on the shift of our particular group out of the 11. And our team, we had always trained fairly rapidly. It wasn't a real slow workout at the Y. So it was, and the coaches here at the training camp, the head coach was Mayo Grossfeld, and then we had, let's see, A.B. Grossfeld, who they had been married but were divorced at the time, and he was an assistant coach, Dick Mulhill, who coached two girls from the training squad from Champaign, Illinois. He was an assistant coach. Dale Flances, who was from our club, was an assistant coach and also going to be a judge at the Olympics. And we had Herb Vogel, who was a coach from Southern Illinois, of one of the girls on the training squad. And she had, there was those four assistants plus the main coaches, the main coach, the head coach. Oh, and then one other one, Vanny Edwards from Centenary College. He was the team manager, so he helped coach us. And so it was pretty much all day in the gym and very slow workouts. There was not very fast-paced, a lot of downtime. I think we could have accomplished a lot more in a shorter period of time.
Uh-huh.
But that wasn't the way the head coach ran her individual club, and it wasn't the way she was going to run this one. So we had to follow her schedule. And we knew that 3 weeks into the training camp, they would select the seven that were going to be the Olympic team. Six would compete and an alternate. The alternate didn't have to be selected or designated right at that time. So they would choose seven. And I just hated this selection process because it's hard to build a team feeling when
right.
You're fighting your teammates for a position on that team every single day. And so I thought it was real, I didn't appreciate that, or didn't like that selection. I thought they should have gone the straight six or seven from the Olympic trials. And then I don't think anybody would have had a problem with putting Linda, our national champion, as long as she was in shape, had recovered from her injuries, putting her on the team, and then just bumping everyone down a spot.
Right.
But that wasn't the process this year. And training was, it was very hard, long. We weren't allowed to eat very much because we were weighed every day before workout and every day after workout. We did our own breakfast. We were not allowed any lunch. We had our own dinner, but we were served our dinner, and it was meat, vegetables, and salad. And there was no dressing, so it was basically just lettuce.
Uh-huh.
And we even had they called a fat cabin, that the girls were overweight. They got moved into the fat cabin.
Fat cabin.
Yeah.
And was it a sauna or something, or what?
That's what we named it, because the girls were, it was just a regular cabin, one of the cabins at Camp Richardson, but the girls were having problem controlling their weight, got moved into that cabin, and when your weight got down, you got moved out again. So that's why we called it the fat cabin.
That's funny. I was wondering what they would think they were doing in that cabin that separating them would help them lose weight. Is it just the stigma?
I think just maybe the stigma of being in there, and they thought they could control you a little bit more in your eating. We couldn't eat very much anyway, but
yeah.
It was very, very difficult, and they didn't know. That was just when nutrition things were starting to come about, that maybe what you ate did affect your performance.
Right.
And their most important thing was we needed to be skinny. So that was it, just not eating very much. And so we just got meat and vegetables and lettuce. And
right.
We tried to sneak some stuff, which we were successful at one time. And one of the gals got sick one night, and they took her to the hospital. She was vomiting up blood, and the doctor diagnosed her as with malnutrition. So, you know, obviously we were not eating properly. And I was to the point where I kind of got afraid to eat, because it just, you can't eat, you have to be skinny, you have to get weighed twice a day, and it was very interesting mentally as to how all this affected you.
Yeah. All right, so how did you find out the final seven? How did they tell you guys?
Okay, they brought us all into one of the main coach's cabin, and we had to stay in the living room area. and they called us in one by one into the bedroom area, shut the door, and there were two or three of the coaches in there telling us, and they just brought us in random order, or random order compared to us. I'm sure they had a method to their madness. And they told us either we were staying or not staying. And I felt by that time I was just totally emotionally drained because of the workouts, the pressure on us. It was just a real hard situation. And so I got in there, and I think I was about the fourth or fifth one brought in out of the 11. I don't even remember for sure. And they said, well, of course you're staying. I had won the Olympic trials. I was first. But that did not guarantee me a spot at all in the final seven.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought I would be staying, but you just never know when it's a selection process. And so I went, and they said, well, of course you're staying, and you need to work harder on this and this and what I needed to improve on. And they said, now we're going to tell you who's leaving. And one of my teammates from the Seattle Y, Cleo, who had been sixth in the trials, she was one of the ones that was cut. And one of the gals who had finished all around fifth at the trials was cut from the team. Let's see. Okay, so those are the two of the top six at the trials were not selected for the final team. And one of those, not the gal from our team, but she had an excellent chance to be the gold medal winner on the uneven bars event at the Olympics. But they cut her from the team, and I still don't know why. I guess they figured she wasn't consistent enough on the other events.
Right.
But I thought to have the U.S. win a gold medal in Olympic Games in gymnastics on an individual event would have just done so much for the sport in the U.S. that it was worth taking her on the team. And I didn't think she was fifth in the trials. She wasn't bad. I don't understand that still after all of these years. Well, it's been over 40 years, and I'm still got very upset when I think of that time.
Have you ever had a chance to talk to any of those coaches since then, or?
I've talked to one. She was actually the gal from our squad, from our club, that was going to be the judge in the Olympics and had been on the 64 Olympic team. And she didn't divulge too many details. She just said it kind of came down to two coaches wanted a certain group, two coaches wanted other individuals in, and so the head coach had to make the decision. And I really don't know what it was based on.
Yeah.
I felt that it should have stayed the way it was in the trials, and Dale kind of intimated that that's how she and the coach that was voting with her felt that the team should have been the one from the trials. But the head coach had to make the decision, and so she chose to cut those two from the team and put two others in their place. And I never heard specific reasons or individual reasons as to why. And what the teammate from my club, Cleo, that was cut, you know, was obviously a very close friend, and I was just devastated for her because I felt she had earned her spot on the team. One of my very good friends, probably my best friend from the Olympic team, was one of the ones that benefited from that selection process, because she was one of the final seven, ended up being the alternate, and not actually competing, but training just as hard as we did. And I hold nothing against her, because it wasn't anything that she had to do with it. It was just the selection process and this decision that was made. So I had one friend lose her spot and one friend gain the spot. So it was real hard in that way, too.
Yeah. Now, after they told you, did you have to go back out and not tell anybody, or how did they do that part of it?
Yes, we couldn't say anything to anybody until all 11 of us had been in the room finding out what the final decision was, and I remember just walking out and leaving and walking around, and you know, I don't even know what I did. I felt like I wanted to cry for the ones who weren't going to make the team, but I was just empty inside. It was just like there was just nothing left. And I remember Cleo saying that when she found out she wasn't going to be included in the final team, we were right on the lake, and she just remember, she says she just went down to the dock and just sat there and thought, you know, maybe I should just jump in the lake right now. And it was just so hard.
Yeah, that's hard.
And you spend your, you know, not your life, but your life at that time working toward this, and she had earned her spot, as had the other gal, and it was just not a good situation, not a good day in the life of my gymnastic experience. And and one of the other gals just, you know, you just don't know what to do.
Right.
And just because they're all your friends, and one of the gals who was cut left right away that evening. And I remember the next day we had to go and train, and Cleo hadn't left yet, so she was sitting in the bleachers watching us at Zephyr High School, and Zephyr Cove High School. And I was out there working, and I felt guilty because I was still there training, and felt she should have been down on the floor with us, and, you know, couldn't because she wasn't a member of the team any longer.
Right.
But so that's the way it was.
After this point, did you guys go back to your hometown before you left for the Olympics itself, or was it just...
No, we didn't. We had, when we came to the trials in the end of August, we had to come prepared to be gone 2 months because we weren't going to be able to go back home. And so we brought a lot more clothes than we actually, I guess, would need, but we did send a lot of the stuff home that we wouldn't need at the Olympics. I remember sending a couple boxes back home, but we were not allowed to go back home. Or not allowed. There just wasn't time and expense also.
And so when you found out you were on the team, did you call your parents? Or, I mean, what?
Yes, I'm sure I did. I don't really remember doing that, but I'm sure I did, and I'm sure Dale, our coach from our club that was there, she called our main coach, George Lewis, in Seattle and told him what went on. And and then Cleo left the next day so she could kind of, you know, give people a take on what was going on at the training camp. But I'm, you know, it's funny, I don't remember doing that, but I'm sure I did.
Uh-huh.
So
from that point, you're getting ready to head down there. The training part of it at Lake Tahoe, did you guys notice the altitude affecting you at all there? I mean, was it...
Maybe at first, but the longest the gymnasts do anything was a minute and a half for a floor exercise, so it really wasn't an issue. I think it was probably good that we trained there just to get our bodies acclimated over the whole month time, and just helped us, I think, deal with just being more comfortable in Mexico City when we got there. But as far as like long distance running and that kind of thing, I don't think it had an effect on our performance at all.
Right.
Because what we did was so short.
Okay, so now you guys are heading out. You're probably getting excited to go down to Mexico City. Did you guys go before the Olympics very in a long period of time, or were you there like right before it started, or how did that...
We actually went to Mexico a week before the opening ceremonies. After the selection, the final selection at Tahoe, we trained there another week, and then we had to go to Denver, which was the processing center for all the Olympic athletes. So all the teams came in pretty much during this 7-day period. We were there for 5 days, where we got our Olympic identification tags, we got all our parade uniforms, travel uniforms, we got suitcases, we got a duffel bag compared to now, but like a carry-on bag, zipper bag that was full of just all sorts of cosmetics, toiletries, slippers, you know, things like that, toothbrushes, stuff like that. And you just went into this big room, and you went down they have a couple tables, or big long tables there, and you just went along the line, and they gave you all this stuff, and then you got measured for your uniforms, and I was reading some of the swimmers, and they said that they wanted our skirts, like we had to be on our knees, and the skirts had to be even with the floor. So we all had to be measured that way, but then we got down in Mexico, or when we actually got our uniforms, everybody hemmed them up, because I know mine was above my knees. Not a whole lot, but it was above my knees. So that was kind of an interesting thing. I didn't really remember that till I had read that from the swimmers. So we get all processed in Denver, and then we leave for Mexico City on... it was a week before the games, or the opening ceremonies. Gymnastics was at the very end of the game. So we were down there, let's see, the first week, and then we had the first week of the Olympic Games before we competed.
Okay.
So we were there quite a while. We didn't get to see a whole lot of Mexico City because we trained twice a day. But we did see a little bit. We got to see a couple other events. And I think it would have been... we could have seen more of the city and of the Olympics, different events, if we had been at the beginning of the games. But the schedule wasn't that way.
Right.
And we were working out a lot of our time. Didn't have too much free time.
Now, just one last thing before we start talking about the games themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 68, those years... you know, pretty turbulent for protesting, and I guess there was a human rights and Harvard crew letter that had gone around for the Olympic team. Had you guys seen anything about that? Or
now, what was that again? I don't think so. Run that by me.
The Olympic Project for Human Rights and Harvard crew letter. There was
I don't remember that at all.
And there were people organizing boycotts. You know, like the track people who eventually did the. You guys hadn't heard of any protests or boycotts?
No, I remember the black, you know, the Black Power salute, and I saw something I think HBO had done earlier, or since then, and it wasn't on TV too long ago. It might have not been HBO, but it was a documentary on the Black Power movement for the Olympics, and I was amazed myself that it had started earlier in the spring and continued probably for 6 months, culminating at the Olympics. And for me, I just thought it was something that happened right at the Olympics, and they just decided kind of spur of the moment to do. But I was amazed to find out that actually this whole thing had been going on for 6 months, and I wasn't aware of it at all.
Okay.
And I told you I was very, very focused.
Yeah.
And I'm not really involved, and still am not. I probably should be more, but in politics and that kind of thing. And I was just... I was totally oblivious to probably anything else that was going on during that time.
Yeah.
And so I had no idea that all this was going on 6 months prior, and so it was really a surprise to me to find that out. And I thought, Joyce, how could you be... this was big news. And
yeah.
How could I just not even hear of it? Maybe not pay real close attention, but not have any idea that it was... transpiring at this point.
Oh, don't feel bad. I've interviewed athletes who were actually at the same school that most of the center of this was all happening, and they didn't even know what was going on. So,
oh, well, that's good. Yeah, now I don't feel quite so bad.
No, don't feel bad. some people are in the loop, and some people don't, and they're focused. It's okay. Now,
I don't remember any of our team or the coaches or anything not being brought up, discussed at all. It
okay.
was just not even mentioned.
That's fine. When you got down to Mexico City, there was an incident with the locals about some students being massacred, shot by the local police. Had you guys heard of any of that when you got down there?
You know, I had to look that up on the internet this morning because I thought, I kept thinking, I have no idea what that was. It starts with a T.
Right.
I don't even know how to pronounce it very well either.
I know what you're talking about, though.
Okay. And I thought, I've got to look that up because that was another thing. I had no idea. And when I saw it on the internet this morning, I thought, well, maybe that rings a bell, but As far as being down there at that time, I don't remember that at all.
Okay. Well, that leads into a good little point here about the security. What was security like down there? I mean, did you notice the presence of security and how they went about
it? I was reading through my diary, and it said when we got to the, we were met by large groups and a lot of people at the airport, and I think we took buses to the village, and I commented in my diary that there was security all over the place, armed guards, and I'm thinking back at the time, or now, looking back, it couldn't have been that much compared to now because just of the difference in the way the world is.
Right.
But there were guards over. You were supposed to be checked going in and out of the village. It was, I'm guessing, like a cyclone fence around it. I don't remember, but I know they did have a fenced area for the Olympic Village, and you had to go through a gate and were supposed to be show your ID tag and be approved. But I know that security was very lax because people would bring their friends through, and they'd say, "Oh, let me see your badge. Oh, they're with me," and the police would. Security people would try and keep them out, but they would end up just walking through.
Yeah.
There were guards milling around throughout the village, but I don't remember it being a huge presence at all.
What were your accommodations like in the village there? And do you remember, like,
food? We stayed in, it was like an apartment building. We were on the fourth or fifth floor, and I'm thinking they're maybe 12 stories high, but there were several of these throughout the village, and I think they were to be used as apartments after the games. So our Olympic team, the gymnastic team, was in one of the apartments. The U.S. team was all in one or two buildings. They didn't mix the buildings with, or mix the teams, the countries, within a building. And so the U.S. was all in our building, and probably, because I think there were about 400 athletes, so there was probably several buildings of just U.S. athletes. Our apartment had three or four bedrooms and a living room, and obviously bathroom in the apartment. And so we were divided up into the three and four rooms. There were swimmers who were alternates that stayed in our living room. They just brought cots or beds in for them. And one of the girls, the alternates, was complaining because she didn't like that they were in the living room with the gymnasts and all of that, but she just had to stay there. She didn't have a choice. So it was... I remember in my diary reading that it was, we said they were very nice, but I remember them being very plain, I mean, like dressers, a dresser in each room with three drawers, I wrote down, and a closet, and it was a good thing we brought extra hangers.
Yeah.
So they weren't fancy, it was kind of an unfurnished apartment with beds in it. And so that was pretty much where we stayed, where we ate, with a cafeteria. Each country, there was six large cafeterias, and the U.S. and Canada were in our cafeteria for our kind of food, and another cafeteria would have been for Asian food and Spanish food and that kind of thing. So we all had meal tickets to get into the specific cafeterias. And there was food galore, but, of course, we couldn't eat very much of it. So,
yeah.
But that's where we had our meals.
Good. Did anybody get... I know you're obviously not supposed to drink the water down there when you're down there, but did anybody get sick from anything like that, the water or anything?
I didn't remember this, but a couple of our team members were sick, but I don't know if it was, there was nothing very long, prolonged, and I think we always drank bottled water.
Uh-huh.
We didn't drink out of the tap. I think we probably brushed our teeth out of the tap,
yeah.
Which probably is just as bad as drinking the water out of the tap, but not as much. I got sick 2 days before the competition, but I think it might have been nerves. But we really didn't have much problem. I'd been to Mexico City four times for gymnastic competitions, including one of them was the Olympics, and I only got sick once the first time I went, and I didn't get sick till I got back home, but I was really sick. But other people did get sick on the other trips that we were on, and I don't know because we always pretty much drank the same thing, ate the same thing.
Uh-huh.
I think it was just kind of luck of the draw. But as far as at the Olympics, our gymnasts were, we were pretty free of that kind of thing.
And now you mentioned earlier that you're you had a good friend that you developed on the team, one of the girls that made the team. Was that pretty much who you hung out with, were the team members and her?
Yes. Yeah, and looking through my journal, we would say, well, so-and-so, you know, in groups we went and it listed the names, and it was kind of interesting. We didn't specifically break up into, like, twosomes or threesomes, but there was definitely a group, you know, four or five of us that if we did something, we usually did it together. And I could kind of tell towards the end of the journal that my friend Diane, that was my closest friend, that we ended up doing more stuff together. And we kept in touch quite a while after gymnastics, then lost touch for about 5 years. And when she had her first baby, she sent a birth announcement to my mom and dad's address, and having no idea if I was still there, they were still there. And that was in 1980. And so so we got back in touch after about 5 years of not being in touch, and have maintained touch ever since, and especially lately, and we're going together to the gymnastic trials down in San Jose in June for this year's Olympics.
Good. That'll be fun.
So, yeah, it'll be great.
So did you guys get to interact with any of the other athletes from other countries very often?
Somewhat. That was one thing. Looking back on my Olympic experience, I feel that I wish I would have taken more advantage of the total Olympic experience. I was focused so much on the gymnastics, which rightfully so, since that's why I was there.
Right.
But I wish I would have taken the chance to converse or just be involved with other athletes, not just the U.S. athletes, but athletes from the other countries also. There was an international building where everybody congregated at night. There was game rooms, television, just room to sit down and chat. And I wish I would have taken more advantage of that type of experience rather than be so focused on just the gymnastic team.
Right.
We did get to know the Czechoslovakian gymnastic team fairly well because their coach had competed with our coaches in the 1964 Olympic team. So we ended up trading uniforms, our USA uniforms with their Czechoslovakian uniforms that had CSSR on the back.
Uh-huh.
But as far as at the Olympic Games, I didn't get to know a lot of the athletes as well as I should have. But at that time, that wasn't important to me. And looking back, I wish that was one thing I would have taken more advantage of.
Right.
And I always tell people now when they go to the Olympics or go to Pan American Games, or I said, take advantage of the whole experience. Enjoy the whole thing, not just your sport and competition.
Because
that was one thing I was sorry I didn't do.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of athletes, but I can also understand why you'd be so focused. I mean, that's what you were, you know, that's why you were there.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So let's go ahead this Olympics was also big because it was the first time they started drug testing and gender testing. And had you guys been tested for anything that you can recollect?
We were tested for gender testing. We had to go in and have the inside of our cheeks swabbed. I don't remember any drug testing at all.
Okay.
We had to fill out a medical questionnaire and just medical background, but I don't remember any drug testing at all.
Did you guys ever, as gymnasts, talk about that subject of gender testing or drug testing, or talk about other athletes from other countries and wonder if they were using it? Or
no.
No.
I don't remember that coming up.
Okay.
At all.
Because I know certain sports, it's more prevalent, and so people would have theories about who's taking what. And
right.
So I wasn't sure if gymnastics did the same.
This was after the fact, but I know the some of the East Germans and the not the Soviets so much, but the East Germans especially, and some of the Soviets, they looked so young and were so skinny, especially the East Germans. We always wondered if they took something to suppress their growth. And this came out later from one of my favorite athletes on the Soviet team, and she said that they would require the gymnasts to, this sounds awful, to get pregnant because it would boost the testosterone levels, and then they would abort the pregnancy after 3 or 4 months, or probably 3 months, it had to be before, but anyway, they had it down, so they would abort the pregnancy, and so then there would be more testosterone in the system, and they would be stronger. And and the one gal said, "Well, it wasn't so bad for me because I had a boyfriend. But if you, even if you didn't have a boyfriend, you still had to go through this." And I just was horrified when I read that. So stuff like that was going on. And with the East Germans, I'm sure that they did something to suppress their growth, or because they were so skinny and just, it was just incredible.
Yeah, that.
But more of that came out after.
Right.
68, and you kind of look back and you think, that was going on.
Yeah, that's so wrong on so many different levels.
It is. So many different levels is right.
All right, so let's talk about your event. The time comes. You said you didn't get out much to other events because you guys were training twice a day.
Right. I think we watched just a couple. We went to a couple track events, but that was about all.
Now, at the track events, had they done the protests yet, or had there been anything?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, because that was near the end, I believe.
Yeah. Okay.
And looking through my journal, it's amazing to me, that was not documented at all. I didn't even write it down.
Okay.
Which I don't, you think I would have, I was surprised at that, Joyce. What were you doing?
Yeah.
But, so it was prior to the Black Power Salute.
Okay, so let's talk about your specific event, the competition, and how it went, and anything.
Okay, I think our competition went well on a personal basis. I was disappointed in my very first event, which was vaulting, compulsory vaulting. But it wasn't bad. I just knew I could do better. That was one of my better events. But overall, as a team, we did very well. And I remember kind of having a grumpy face when I came off after my vault, and our head coach Muriel looked at me and she said, "Wipe that frown off your face. You did fine. Let's move on to the next event." And everything else, I was pleased with my performance, and we had one break on bars and our optionals, but overall as a team we were very, very pleased with how we performed. So our training, as hard as it was, did pay off. And competing in the Olympics, it was exciting. I remember waving to the crowd and being cheered this time after we, as we left the stadium, I guess, or the gym or arena, we marched around the arena on our way out and waved to the crowd and got applauded. So that made us feel good.
Had you had anybody come down to watch you?
My parents and brother went down, and also my personal coach wasn't able to come down. One of the other coaches from the Y was there. There were several other gymnasts that, gymnastic people that we knew that were down there. And Dr. Eric Hughes, who was the men's University of Washington gymnastic coach, he and his wife were down there also on the same tour with my parents. And so we did get to see them a couple times before the games and then, of course, after.
Did you notice them in the stands at all when you were competing?
No, not at all, because it's not like now when parents of the, I don't know about other sports, but parents of the gymnasts, they always know where they are in the arena, and they usually show them on TV, the top performing ones. My parents had tickets way, way up in the top, and my brother says the lights were hanging down from the ceiling, and where they were sitting was above the lights.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were really high, and it was very hot up there, and my brother was in between my mom and my dad. He says that was not the place to be because they were so nervous for me, and it was hot, but they were there watching, yes.
The competition, did you feel like you guys were as good athletes, or could you notice the difference in their abilities, the Eastern Bloc countries, things like that?
I feel we, the U.S. as a team, we were doing as much difficulty as any of the other countries. We just didn't have the perfection down,
uh-huh.
the little tiny things.
Just started a new recorder. All right, so we just finished with, I was going to ask you a quick question. Back then, they didn't have pre-recorded music for your routines, correct?
Right. Let's see, we had a piano player.
Do you remember her name?
A live piano player. And our club had our own piano player who was the mother of one of our gymnasts, not one of the ones that went to the trials, but she, and I don't think she went to the trials with us. No, because we would record our music at a studio where she was playing, and then we would take the tapes with us. But for the Olympics, Olympic Games, we did have our own piano player, as did most of the countries. And so she would learn all our music and learn which move went where. And so they had a piano set up by the floor, and our player would just go out and play our music as each of us went up.
Yeah. You mentioned or you asked earlier who I've interviewed, and I got to interview that lady who played the piano for you guys.
Oh, really? Pat Melcher, I think?
Uh-huh. Yeah, she was really nice.
Yeah, I have not heard from her or, been in touch with her at all since she played. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
That you got her perspective.
And she said she was going to come down here to Austin for some music conference or festival she mentioned, so she wants to come down and look at the facility and stuff. It was interesting to hear her perspective on how she had to play to try and watch you guys while you were doing your routines and try and keep everything timed. It was interesting.
All right,
so the rest of the Olympics after so you felt pleased with how you guys performed.
Our team finished sixth, and that was the highest that any U.S. women's gymnastic team had placed. The 64 team was ninth, and to break into the top six in gymnastics is huge because it's so hard to break into what was kind of the communist block at that time.
Uh-huh.
And especially being a judge sport and subjective, it was real hard for the U.S. to get into that top six. So that was a major milestone. So we were really pleased that our team was finally in that top six, and hopefully that would be a springboard for better and future performances.
Right. I saved this kind of for the end here, but we didn't talk about the opening ceremonies, but I think we'll just talk about it as the opening and closing ceremonies, what your memories are of those ceremonies, because we kind of skipped over that.
Is that what we're doing now?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about that. So you flew down there, and you were down there a week ahead of time, and now you said you had special uniforms for going in.
Yes, we had our parade uniforms. They were a white dress with chevron, a blue and red chevron on them. And we had a purse that we had to carry and special shoes, special stockings. And we all marched in rows. Now they just do it very casually. But we were in rows. And we had a couple practices when we were down in Mexico to get our lineups and all the women first, all the men behind, and then they voted on, I guess, who would carry the flag, the dignitaries that would be in front. And being a gymnast means you're short, so I was very fortunate to be in the front row.
Uh-huh.
And so that was really special because you could see a lot better when you were marching around.
Right.
And I just remember it being very long. We had to be there early, line up, and then march to another area and wait another hour. And then finally, there were 109 countries. So, and being in Spanish, United States was AZ Tazuni, so we were E, so we were fairly near the beginning. And the way the stadium was set up, it was, you went through a tunnel. I saw a picture of this recently, and it wasn't as much of a tunnel as I remembered, but it was definitely part of a tunnel. And you walked in, and then all of a sudden, especially being in the front row, you're just in the stadium with 80,000 people yelling and screaming and cheering for us. And it was just extremely overwhelming. And marching in the opening ceremonies is the most exciting and my favorite moment of all the 10 years I competed in gymnastics. It was absolutely just unbelievable. And so I walked in, and we all marched in and start walking around, and I just was thinking, wow, this is the Olympics. And for so long, since I've been 12 years old, my goal was the Olympics. It was a word, I want to go to the Olympics, And even through the trials and the training camp, but marching in the stadium for those opening ceremonies, it really dawned on me that I said, I am in the Olympics. This is it, what I've worked for 6 years. I'm here. I did it. And it was absolutely incredible. And I've spoken to a lot of other athletes, either through Facebook or just person to person, and they say the same thing, that marching in the opening ceremonies was unbelievable. Nothing like they thought it would be. It was so, so much more.
Yeah, most of the athletes I've talked to, that sticks out in their mind is the opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. And on the questionnaire that I was sent, it says, what was the most meaningful part of the 1968 games? And by far, it was the opening ceremonies. It just made it all real, and all our hard work had culminated, and I'd reached my goal. Very, very exciting. Made me very proud of myself, as well as representing the U.S.
Do you remember what the outfit was they had you wear, by the way?
I still have it. It was, it's a white dress. It was out of a polyester material, kind of a spongy. It's real odd. There's nothing like it now out there. But it was long sleeves, had a slight kind of a mock turtleneck, zipped up the back, kind of A-line style. It was all white, and then it had the blue and white chevron across the front. Our chest area.
I see. Yeah. You know how Olympics nowadays, everybody wants to see what the countries are wearing. And
I know.
Yeah.
And ours, it looked really nice. It was very impressive looking, and it looks like nothing compared to now. People look at it and they go, oh. But it was very sharp looking, and the guys had, I think, blue pants, red blazers. Let's see, I've got a picture. It's on the lookbook book. And the blue shirts, maybe? Let's see here. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay. I heard a beep, and I didn't know. Sometimes I hit the wrong button on
the
phone.
No, you're good.
They had white pants, white pants, red blazers, blue shirt. Yeah, no hats or anything like that. And it's very sharp looking.
Uh-huh.
So it's just very different from what you see now. And like I said, we were all in very straight rows, and we marched around the whole stadium keeping in formation. And Kathy Rigby, who was one of the other gymnasts on our team, she was like the right front. And it was when we went by the dignitary area, she had to yell out something like, turn right. And so we all turned our heads to the right to acknowledge the dignitary area.
Uh-huh.
And then you walk, 20 yards or something. And we all did. That's what we did. So everybody turned and acknowledged. They don't even do that now, because everybody just comes in as a team, but they're all over the place. So
right.
It shows how times have changed.
So contrast that with the closing ceremonies. How was that for you?
Closing ceremonies, I was in the stands, and I think it was much more impressive to me watching from the stands, but I don't, not as meaningful, but I think a lot of it was because I was right out on the field, and you couldn't see everything that was going on, and you couldn't look down on it like you can from the stands.
Uh-huh.
But the closing ceremonies were great too, because it was just a release of all the tension and everything, and a lot of the athletes went down from the stands after the official ceremonies were done. I didn't. I was with another gal from our club. So we went out to eat afterwards, but it was very fun, a lot more not so structured and very joyful and playful at the closing ceremonies. But I do remember noticing they had the Mexico 68 sign. It was all dark and fireworks were going off, and then that Mexico 68 went blank, and then it was Munich 72. And that was a pretty powerful moment, because at that time I planned on training till 1972 and working to make that team that I ended up quitting in 1970. But at that time, I remember that being a very powerful moment and saying, I will be there. It didn't turned out I wasn't, but so they were both very good, just kind of for different reasons.
Okay.
Totally different atmosphere.
So let's wrap the Olympics up, because you just brought up a good topic of what you did after the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you remember or want to share about the Olympic experience before we transition into your post-Olympic stuff?
Let's see.
The media. How about the media? Did you remember media coverage at all, seeing television cameras or...
Not too much. I know some of the local Seattle reporters were down there, and I remember them asking, I didn't find this out till later, but asking our head coach if I could come to one of the interviews, because he wanted to interview me, and she said, well, no, because Joyce gets too nervous, and I didn't know that transpired until I got home and read one of the articles that he wrote, but it would have been nice for her to let me make that decision.
Right, right.
Rather than have her say, because this was a reporter that I knew from doing gymnastics in Seattle, and he was a great guy, wonderful guy. And so it would have been really fun to actually have been in-person interviewed down at the Olympics. But, see, the U.S. gym team wasn't real... We weren't winning gold medals at that time, so the press wasn't... We had coverage, but not like a lot of the top athletes.
And that's interesting, because nowadays the gymnastics, especially the female gymnastics, is so highly rated.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I think that our breaking into the top six at that Olympics was the start. It kind of gave a big boost to what's transpired now. And I know it's one of the questions, I think we'll probably talk about this at the end, is the preservation and the history and stuff. And,
uh-huh. Well, you can talk about it now.
I'll get into that at the end.
Okay. All right. Well, let's transition then into, you mentioned your life a little bit after gymnastics. You know, you said you obviously kept training for a couple of years.
Yes. When I got home, the plan was to take some time off and then start college and continue training through the 72. And... when we got home, I could only take 2 weeks off because we had a clinic that we had already scheduled that was up in Vancouver, British Columbia, and so we had to at least get back in the gym a little bit to go up and be prepared to do that clinic. And if I would have known and been a little stronger about my feelings, I would have done the clinic and then come back and taken more time off. But instead, we just went right back working in the gym. Not real hard, but I was in the gym and started working. And I knew I wasn't ready to go back mentally into the gym again, but I didn't speak up. And so it was a very hard couple months after that, because everybody expected me to be there. I didn't want to be there, and that's not a very good combination.
Yeah.
And I always think that if I had taken, you know, even a couple months, which is pretty long in gymnastic circles, taken a couple months off and just totally gotten away, that I might have continued on till 1972. I don't know for sure, but I have a real strong feeling that it... just taking a bigger break might have made the difference and, you know, enabled me to enjoy the sport for longer than I ended up doing.
So what brought it to an end? Was there just a point where you were just like, I'm done, or?
It kind of happened over a few months period. I, you know, realized I kind of wasn't happy doing gymnastics, and I thought, you've either got to make a decision to go for it all the way, 100%, or quit. And because it's not something I can do halfway or even 90%, it just doesn't work with any sport. And so I had this big talk with myself, and I thought, okay,
you have to decide what you're going to do. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go for it 100%. And I had really good workouts. Just mentally, everything was better. Physically, everything was coming into place. I got back into really good shape. And that lasted for a while. And I don't know what happened. It just kind of started to spiral downwards, and I just wasn't happy being in the gym and doing this anymore. And when that happened, I started seeing all the bad things about gymnastics, all the judging controversies, the controversy between different coaches, and I saw all the bad things. They weren't different things that had not been going on all my prior career, but I just noticed them more. Before, I was just, they happened, but I'm not going to even worry about it.
Right.
But then at this time, that was all I saw. And I kind of was doing gymnastics for other people. The people expected me to continue, and that doesn't work. I always tell people now, if you're going to do it for yourself, not for someone else. And it was amazing to me after I quit and talking to other gymnasts over the years that how many of them say, well, I did it because my coach wanted me to do it. I did it because my dad wanted me to do it. I did it because this person wanted me to do it. And I was just incredulous because it was just the last couple months that I felt I was doing it not for myself. And so one day I just decided, you know, I don't have to be this unhappy. I don't live in Russia. I don't have to do this. And so I thought, I'm not going to do it.
Were you in college at that point?
Yes, I was in college.
Mm-hmm. Where was that? Where was that at?
University of Washington.
Okay, I was going to guess that, but I wasn't sure.
Yep, and I was in. I'm a pharmacist now, so I was in the pharmacy program.
Gotcha.
And it was a very difficult decision, but I ended up going to our two national meets that year because I was defending champion, and my mom said, "Well, why don't?" It's a couple more months. Why don't you just finish out this season, and then you can decide what you want to do. And they put absolutely no pressure on me at all. It was totally up to me after all the years that they put into it and expense and everything. So I went to the meet, and it was okay. I didn't do particularly well, but I ended up third. And so I came home and just tried, and see, you can see, I can still feel the feelings that I had then. Just a second.
That's okay.
Let me get a drink of water.
You're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, it was very hard for me to realize I didn't like something that I had loved for so long.
Right.
And I think that was the hardest. And I really didn't know why. I just knew it wasn't fun anymore. And like I said, if it's not fun, don't do it. So I just, you know, took a month after that meet and just really thought about it. Didn't do anything because I was out of school at that time. College had been done for the summer. And I just decided I just couldn't or didn't want to go back to the gym anymore.
Right.
And so I had no idea I would cry when I was talking to you about this.
It's okay. It's not... effect, it's not bad at all. You're more than welcome.
But I think that was the hardest thing because it was so hard for me to quit something that I had loved for so long. And but I really didn't know why it had changed all of a sudden. So, but I made that decision, and people told me later they thought I had made the wrong decision because it was after our national meet, but before a world championship team later in that year, and we still had the trials and everything to go for. And they thought I probably should have continued through the trials, and if I made the team, then compete, and then make the decision. But the thought of just even being in the gym for a couple more months was, I just couldn't do it. So I ended up going to watch one of my other teammates that was in the trials, and I missed the competition immediately, and I missed the competition for a couple years, but I didn't miss the working out, and you can't compete well without
practicing.
You know, training real hard. So it was an impossible situation. Even though I missed the competition, I didn't miss it so much that I wanted to get back in the gym. So it was in spring of 1970 that I decided to finally call it quits, and it was the right decision, because I can remember thinking, getting up in the morning and thinking, I don't have to go to the gym today. So
then you know you made the right decision, if that's the feeling of,
it was the time, and it was the right decision rather than continuing on and not being very happy about it. So
well, I appreciate
a very emotional one, as you can see.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you sharing that with us. It's always good to get, you know, people's real emotions about stuff and how they feel about it. So you mentioned earlier you wanted to share some reflections or something back on, there was a question you said you wanted to comment on.
Oh, at the very end, what does the preservation of the 1968 U.S. team legacy mean to
you? Yeah, let's talk about that one first, and then maybe finish up with, how are you involved with gymnastics at all nowadays? Because you mentioned you were going to some place in San Jose.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll do the legacy thing first,
okay,
so that's the preservation of this. And I think it's really important because, and I'm really glad that Dr. Hunt has taken this on, because he, I don't think people in general, and especially athletes and the coaches, I don't think they appreciate the history of the games or a particular sport. And are you still there? I heard that.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm still listening.
I keep leaning on something. You know, that took place for them to be able to be at the level that things are now. And especially in gymnastics, the first medal winners, like, were in the current era, like Mary Lou Retton in 1984.
Uh-huh.
They're lauded, but I don't think they realize, they kind of think they're the beginning of this great big gymnastic thing in the U.S., and I don't think they think back and realize how much hard work that the coaches, the athletes, and the families that supported the athletes put in to get them to that point where winning medals was actually a possibility.
Right, right.
And especially in a judge sport like gymnastics, how hard it is to make that jump into the top six and then into the top three and then into that gold medal spot, where a lot of the gymnastic people now, they've never been in a spot where you don't compete for medals at the Olympics. You don't compete for the top medals. And I think they forget that there was a lot of background and how different it was back then.
Uh-huh.
Well, and I think that's important to kind of hear the differences.
And like you said, with judging sports, it's almost the reputation that helps a little bit, too. Like you said, once you break into that certain group,
it
seems like
exactly,
the judges look at you differently.
Mm-hmm, they do. Right or wrong, it happens.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. All right, so then, what have you kept up with the sport at all since that you gave it up? Because it sounds, I mean, obviously it's in your voice that you love the sport.
I always thought I would coach, but after, I coached at some summer camps for a couple years after I quit, and I just, to coach, you have to be in the gym, and it made me realize that I was just tired of being in a gym. It wasn't necessarily the working out and doing the work myself. It was just being in a gym. I just wasn't ready to do that. And oftentimes I thought maybe going down to a local club and, you know, say, well, could I come in two or three days a week and work on so-and-so or work on this particular aspect of gymnastics with your kids? And that passed just because it takes time, and I just being in the gym doesn't really appeal to me anymore.
Yeah.
I still keep in touch with it through, there's a couple of gymnastic magazines that I get, and much to my husband's dismay.
Yeah.
And keep in touch with our local Seattle group especially, and, you know, through letters or email with the computer. It makes it a lot easier nowadays. We've had some reunions of our Olympic team. We had one of our Olympic team in 1988, so that was 20 years. And it's amazing to me that when we get together, even though we don't keep in touch a whole lot, when we get together, what we went through was so special and grueling that there's just a bond there that will never, ever go away. And we had a reunion just in the middle of March of our Seattle Y team in Seattle, and there was a Pacific Rim International Gymnastic meet there. So that was the impetus and incentive to get this going. And we had about 28 people come, some from all over the United States, and it was just amazing to get together and share the stories and see each other after so long. And again, that's a bond that we had, and our gymnastic situation at the Seattle Y was very unique and very special to all of us, and special in the country. It was after hearing stories of other gymnasts from other clubs around the country, we really had a great situation in Seattle, and just a very special one, and it's nice to get everybody together to realize how special it is, not just to me, but to everybody who competed with George Lewis at the Y. People find out they're in the Olympics, or that I was in the Olympics. The first thing they say, oh my gosh, you were in the Olympics? I say yes, and they ask when and where, and then the next question is usually, well, did you win any medals? And when I say no, they kind of get this, you know, sad look on their face like, oh, well, that's too bad.
Yeah.
But I always tell them, I say, well, not winning medals didn't make it any less exciting or less thrilling to me or mean any less than it did to those who win medals. Just because I didn't win, I didn't feel bad. It still was an extremely special experience. And I think it's hard for them to understand that if you didn't win a medal,
that it was a failure.
You weren't very good. But
right.
To me, the Olympics was the absolute highest I could go in my sport. And that was why I wanted to be in the Olympics, because that meant I would be the best in the U.S. or one of seven. And just because I didn't win any medals doesn't mean I didn't achieve my goals or reach the very top of gymnastics for me. And I think that's real important for people to understand.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right, especially with, and it might be a societal thing that winners are so idolized and, you know, that just competing isn't thought of high enough, I don't think.
I think that's true. Yes,
and especially at that level, Olympics, just getting to the Olympics itself is pretty select group, you know?
Right, especially in gymnastics, they take, you know, seven every 4 years, and now it's down to five this year.
Uh-huh.
And in other swimming or track events, they take two per event or three per event. And
yeah,
when you think of it that way, there's not very many that reach that.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. One of the questions on the sheet that I've gotten was about the memories of the Soviet bloc athletes. And
okay.
We didn't get to intermingle or too much with them at all, but that was right before, or the Olympics were right after the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia.
Uh-huh.
And kind of took over. And since we were closer with the Czechoslovakian team due to previous connections from the 1964 Olympics, we found out a little bit of background information, and they said Vera Koslovska, who won the Olympic all-around that year in 68, was from Czechoslovakia, and she had to go into hiding when the Soviets invaded that country, and so she shoveled coal to keep in shape before they could leave for Mexico.
Wow.
And so that was very interesting to learn. And then also when the USSR, they won the team award that year, and Czechoslovakia was second. And as a part of a silent protest, Vera bowed her head when they were playing the non-national anthem for the Soviet Union when they were during the team awards.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought that was very interesting. And from my diary, reading through it, the crowd definitely was rooting for Vera Kafoska and not some of the Russians. It was very evident in the crowd and the gymnastic competition. And then also one of our teammates who couldn't march in the opening ceremonies, was in the stands, and she said that when Czechoslovakia entered the stadium, everyone, all 80,000 people, stood and cheered for them.
Uh-huh.
As, you know, showing support for their country compared, or after what the Soviets had done. So.
Right. So, yeah, you said she was first in the all-around?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but her team was second
in the
team awards, but she won the all-around that year.
How did she, did you see the award ceremony for that?
Yes.
How did she look up there? Did she look pleased? Was she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very happy.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Good deal.
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing that story.